frankly, Mr. Secretary, I think that your performance is despicable. And I think the fact that you are not willing to provide answers to this committee is absolutely atrocious.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Like, if you'd like to have a minute to respond, you
would. Oh, I would, and I'm not sure I'll limit it to 60 seconds.
That's fine.
Number one, what I found despicable is the implication that this language, tremendously odious, actually could be emblematic of the sentiments of the 260,000 men and women of the Department of Homeland Security. Number one. Number two, Senator Hawley takes an adversarial approach to me in this question, and perhaps he doesn't know my own background. Perhaps he does not know that I am the child of a Holocaust survivor. Perhaps he does not know that my mother lost almost all her family at the hands of the Nazis. And so I find his adversarial tone to be entirely misplaced. I find it to be disrespectful of me and my heritage. And I do not expect an apology, but I did want to say what I just articulated. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I just respond since he has referenced me personally?
Senator Hawley, we need to move on. Senator Romney, you're...
As Christians in a Christian country, we have a right to be, at minimum, agnostic about the leadership being all Jewishly occupied.
We literally should be at war with fucking Israel 100 times over, and instead we're just sending them money, and it's fucking craziness.
Look at the state of Israel, look at the state of Tel Aviv, and look at the state of Philadelphia. You tell me where this money's going. You tell me who's benefiting from this.
I am prepared to die in the battle fighting this monstrosity that would wish to enslave me and my family and steal away any rights to my property and to take away my God. Go fuck yourself. Will I submit to that?
And if you've got a foreign state, you've got dual citizens in your government, who do you think they're supporting?
God, right now, would you protect the nation of Israel and protect those of us, not just our church, but every church in the world and in this nation that's willing to put their neck on the line and say, we stand with them.
You go to Trump's cabinet, you go to Biden's cabinet, it's full of Jews.
In school, I have nothing against blacks. She has nothing against me. She understands where I'm coming from.
Excuse me, I'm a Jew, and I just like to say that, you know, in our Bible it says that you're like animals.
The Jews crucified our God.
That's right. Coming in just a few days away from the release of that game-changing film, Occupied. If you want early access, if you want access at all to that film, you have to go to StuPeters.com and click on the Stu Crew button. Or click on the Stu Crew button below any of our Rumble broadcasts. You know, groveling to and really worshiping the Jew has become a centerpiece of American national identity. It's this sort of religious sacrament ever since, well, I don't know, the end of World War II. The idea that Jews are not only perpetual victims who we must save and support at all costs, but that also there are superiors, and that we must obey them, and that we must serve them. And this has been deeply entrenched into the American psyche, especially of the post-war era. It's really become this foundational building block for the way that the American people view themselves, the way that they view their country, the way that they view the entire world. These people's only historical links to this country involve bringing in thousands of slaves, exploiting our free markets, exploiting our openness, all for their own gain, and wrangling us into this Rothschild-run central banking machine before unleashing communism on every man and every woman and every child. But yet still, it's just been drilled into the average American's head that we owe them something, up to and including our lives.
as if they really are God's chosen people, as your subverted Schofield Bible thumping uncle might tell you, or pastor. But you know, the truth is, they're not. Instead, this is a group of people who Jesus Christ called the synagogue of Satan. This is a group of people who cooked up horrific genocide porn ideas in their heads and sold them to the world and then used it to seize control of other people's land. To pour into the Middle East from Eastern Europe, from places like Ukraine, and then use it to give themselves legitimacy and a base of operations, the front lines of the military-industrial complex. They have spawned influence operations and pressure groups that, with extremely deep pockets linked all the way back to their central banking cartel, have completely consumed our government at every single level. On all sides, it's constant. It never stops. But you know what the problem with that is? It's all a lie. These people are profiting and ruling the world and forcing Europeans to pay them reparations on the back of a lie. Not just one lie, many lies. And we don't really have to look very far back in history to see this massive Jewish lie, a Jewish trick that has now killed hundreds of thousands of people. It's completely changed the course of the world. And it's likely set us right down the road to World War III. It was just last year on October 7th that Hamas came pouring right through Israel's border, where there just so happened to be a gigantic hole in the U.S.-funded wall and an orchestrated failure of the U.S.-funded Iron Dome. Nobody was standing guard. Nobody was ready to respond. And of course, then we were just told that Hamas just took it upon themselves to launch terrorist attacks against a bunch of Israelis dancing at rave parties along the Gazan border. They're always dancing. And before this attack even happened, the IDF, Israel's government, and our government, they all knew that it was going to take place. They probably helped to plan it. And then they let it happen. Why? So that they could make the pretext that they needed to go to war and start the next phase of global Jewish tyranny. That's why they did that. They needed an excuse to go into Gaza and start blasting the heads off of women and children and bombing their schools and their libraries and their churches and firebombing their own people and driving the entire population into a tiny corner of the country so that they could shoot them like fish in a barrel. And of course, the ones that they don't kill, they'll just send to the West if anyone is left over. Israel's military responded to this attack by turning the entire region to fire. They burnt their own citizens alive. They slaughtered them with bombs and rockets and bullets. They destroyed everything in sight. And that's not being hyperbolic. That's not a conspiracy theory. Their own troops admitted this. But they told the world that Hamas burnt up a bunch of little kids. They used AI photos and said that babies were ripped from their mother's wombs and set on fire. They lied about women being gang raped. They lied about innocent hostages being tortured. All of it was a lie. It was all a Jewish fantasy. It was absolutely sick. But you see, this is something that runs deep in Jewish blood. It lives deep inside their collective brain. It's really no different than the Holocaust fantasies that Jews have been cooking up for over 80 years. They talk about this 6 million number fantasy every chance that they get. It's a fairy tale. Even though places like Auschwitz have had to admit that nowhere near that number of people were killed. Because, yeah, the numbers don't add up. Nobody gassed and burnt millions of people and completely erased them from the earth in a period of 4 or 5 years. It just didn't happen. It's not even possible. But they used that lie, which originated in Bolshevik propaganda, and they use it to blackmail the rest of the world into letting them steal everything from other people. To steal their land, to embark on the wholesale slaughter of kids, and drive an entire ethnic group into oblivion. Just like they're doing to the Palestinians. like they've been doing since 1948 when their illegitimate fake nation state of Israel was founded, and since well before that, as they waged terror campaigns in Palestine in an effort to kill people and scare them away. The same type of Islamic terrorism Israel tells us so much about is exactly what they pioneered. It was called Zionism, and all of it was built on lies. Lies about who these people are, lies about where these people came from, and lies about what's happened to them along the way. They lie every single second of every single day. And that's why films like Occupied from the Stu Peters Network are so important. And that's why guests like our next one and the work that he does is so important, not just for this audience, but for all of humanity. Guillermo Rudolph is a close friend of the program. You've heard me talk about the Holocaust Encyclopedia that he published. You've seen me use it. It sits right here on my news desk. This is an amazing piece of work. It completely blows the lid off of the fake Holocaust narrative, just like Occupied is going to blow the lid off of the Jewish subversion of this country. That, by the way, is not Guillermo's only piece of work. He's also written another book called Nazi Gas Chambers, The Roots of the Story, that goes much further in depth and does more to expose this totally fake gas chamber story that perhaps everyone has heard about. And you can get that book and others for yourself by visiting HolocaustEncyclopedia.com or AMREG.us. That's AMREG.us. All of this, we're now joined by our good friend, Guillermo. Sir, thank you so much for coming back. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me again. Well, the website is ARM, like ARMREG.
ARMREG, A-R-M-R-E-G. I've been telling people HolocaustEncyclopedia.com, but to get your new book, they should go to ARMREG.us.
Yes, but the Holocaust Encyclopedia website has a link in the menu that says bookstore, which links it direct there. So,
all right, so if anybody's having a problem out there remembering, HolocaustEncyclopedia.com is where you can go to get this, I mean, this unbelievable piece of work. By the way, please get a physical copy. We all know the internet is not safe. We all know that there's a kill switch for the internet. We all know that this work right here is exactly what the internet is intended to stop. And so make sure that you get the physical copy. Holding it up on television doesn't do this book a justice. I mean, there is so many citations in here. How long did it take you to put this together, by the way?
Well, it's the fruit of 35 years of research. I have compiled and published over the last 35 years of serious Holocaust handbooks, which is by now, I'm just working on volume 53. This is a compendium of archival and forensic studies covering the entire territory, and it has taken us a number of scholars. I'm just basically the publisher, and the website is actually holocausthandbooks.com, which is a separate website. And you can find it there. So if at some point you want to pull it up at holocausthandbooks.com, you can see the site. All the books are available for download as free PDF there, so you wouldn't have to buy the physical copy. But the research we've done over 35 years is so detailed, and that's right, there it is. It's so detailed and so massive that it's very difficult to wrap your head around it. So eventually I figured we need to have something that condenses it down to the essentials and makes it accessible by enabling people to look up keywords. So that's what an encyclopedia does. And after 35 years of working on this, I had gathered the knowledge and the access to all the information to compile such work. And that's the fruit of it. And actually, if you write an encyclopedia, then you have to really master the entire territory. I've worked on it 35 years, and I had kind of an overview, but when I actually sat down and had to write it step by step, keyword by keyword, interlinking everything, I really had to make sure I have it all together and I know what I'm talking about. So it was a massive learning project for me too. And I have connected a few dots I hadn't seen before, came to understanding of how this entire myth of the gas chamber has developed. And that's the new book that you mentioned about. Here it is, Nazi Gas Chambers, The Roots of the Story. It's a much smaller book. It just has maybe 130 pages of text. And it condenses down the essentials of the story, how they evolved, where it started all from, and how it was turned into the narrative that we are fed today. Because the origin of the story, the roots are actually much more complicated. Yeah, that's the AMREG website, and there down you see the second book in the line, that Nazi Gas Chambers. That's there it is. Right, you click on it and you get directly to the site where you can buy it. Now, that's a site that's currently only located in the UK, so that's why it's in British pounds. We're working on having a US website that will be probably accessible starting early next year. Yes, I actually, last time we spoke about your upcoming documentary, and you sent me links to four teasers, and I watched them. And you had a number of things in there that speaks about those atrocity tales that the Israelis have been pushing all the Zionists about, babies being beheaded by the Hamas fighters, and babies being ripped out of the wombs of pregnant women, or babies being baked in ovens. And that reminded me of a lot of the stories that are actually summarized in many entries of the Holocaust Encyclopedia. One of the most prominent witnesses that has testified about the Holocaust is, of course, Elie Wiesel. Everybody knows that name, I assume. And his claim to fame is not that he has experience in any way, shape, or form a gas chamber. He actually never talked about gas chambers in his book, The World Famous Night. But he says when he arrived at Auschwitz, he stepped out of the train, was on the railway platform, and then they were directed, they had to walk toward the end of the platform, and then they could see huge flaming burning trenches where the SS was throwing in living babies, and those living babies were burning in those trenches. And he was directed to another trench right next to that railway ramp where grown-ups were being burned alive. And just few meters before he was supposed to jump in, he was directed to go to a different direction, and he survived. So you have there the theme of killing babies, which is something that you see in many witness accounts, killing them in various ways, throwing them over the heads of people in the gas chamber, smashing their heads in, shooting them like sparrows. That is one of the most cruel aspects of the testimonies, because we're all geared toward reacting with the utmost alarm if we see or hear about someone killing babies, because babies, that is our most intensive and heartfelt investment into life. If we ever have babies, that's what is most important to us, and if we see or hear anyone killing them, then we get all riled up. This is a propaganda theme that has always been pushed to push people into war, into enabling a person to kill another person. If you can make me believe that my neighbor kills baby for a living, I'm prepared to go over and kill him. That's the easiest way of fueling wars. Now with Elie Wiesel, the good part of that testimony is that he locates it right next to the book now railway ramp, and we have lots of air photos taken by Allied reconnaissance photos around the time that he arrived there, May, June, July of 1944, and they show very clearly that there was no burning pit anywhere near that railway ramp or anywhere in Auschwitz-Birkenau. And so nowadays, even mainstream historians and literature experts accept that Elie Wiesel made it up. So there's no truth to it. This is not the only one. You can go through the encyclopedia and find many more of these cliches, of babies being killed, of burning trenches, of smoking chimneys. It has actually now an entry, cliches of the Holocaust, where generally believed cliches that are widespread are being debunked. Those burning trenches and flaming chimneys and so forth is one of those points.
You have to be a very sick, special kind of sick person to just make things up like that. And that's not the only thing that they made up. I mean, there's a lot of things where I just look at these things that you have in the encyclopedia, some of these things that we were taught in school. A lot of them that we weren't, but that you've heard through various testimonies and witness accounts, these absurd, just like horrific things to imagine. But imagining that somebody could actually make it up out of whole cloth and just completely lie about some of this extraordinary mistreatment, and it's just unbelievable.
Right. I've been wading through these kind of testimonies now for 35 years, and I'm kind of used to it. So it makes you become a little bit calloused. By the way, by accident, I didn't arrange how the alphabet is being sorted, but the first entry in the encyclopedia happens to be absurd claims, and I have a collection of these things, and you've mentioned a few lately. I've actually added a new one lately, a claim that Jews were made to go into the surrounding swamps about Auschwitz because it was a kind of a swampy area, collected the swamp gas that was developing there from decomposing plants in order to use that biogas then in order to gas Jews in the camp. So that's kind of funny. It was completely absurd.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of a special kind of sick you have to be to think right. Some of this stuff up. It's just absolutely
unbelievable. When it comes to the baby stories, this is not just exclusively territory for Jews. We have, I don't know whether you remember the 1991 invasion of Kuwait by Iraq.
Yes, of course.
And then, of course, we had the first Gulf War that was driving the Iraqis out of Kuwait. And one of the most important events that made the United Nations General Assembly accept the necessity to use force to drive the Iraqis out was a testimony by a 15-year-old female teenager from Kuwait describing in front of the General Assembly of the United Nations how the Iraqis came into hospitals in Kuwait, ripped babies out of incubators, threw them on the ground, and killed them that way.
Yeah.
It turned out that this whole story was completely made up, and not just made up. The 15-year-old girl was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. She was a member of the royal family of Kuwait, which nobody was told. She was coached to tell this invented story by a PR firm called Hill & Knowlton that had figured it out with making investigations how and to what kind of story people react most viscerally. And the story has been, and not a surprise, killing babies. That's what people rise up people most. So there has been a systematic marketing approach. Still known as actually a marketing company, a marketing approach to find out how can we sell the world to go to war against Saddam Hussein, which the years before had been supported in his war against the Iranis. So you see the pattern there. And
thank you very much. Our final witness is also using an assumed name, and again we ask our friends in the media to respect the need to for her to protect her family. And we finally call on Naira to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Naira, and I just came out of Kuwait. My mother and I were in Kuwait on August 2nd for a peaceful summer holiday. My older sister had a baby on July 29th. And we wanted to spend some time in Kuwait with her. I only pray that none of my 10th grade classmates had a summer vacation like I did. I may have wished sometime that I could be an adult, that I could grow up quickly. What I saw happen to the children of Kuwait and to my country has changed my life forever. It has changed the life of all Kuwaitis, young and old. We are children no more. My sister, with my five-day-old nephew, traveled across the desert to safety. There is no milk available for the baby in Kuwait. They barely escaped when their car was stuck in the desert sand, and help came from Saudi Arabia. I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after invasion, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor. It was horrifying. I could not help but think of my nephew, who, if born premature, might have died that day as well. After I left the hospital, some of my friends and I distributed flyers condemning the Iraqi invasion until we were warned we might be killed if the Iraqis saw us. The Iraqis have destroyed everything in Kuwait. They stripped the supermarkets of food, the pharmacies of medicine, the factories of medical supplies, ransacked our houses, and tortured neighbors and friends. I saw and talked to a friend of mine after his torture and released by the Iraqis. He is 22, but he looked as though he could have been an old man. The Iraqis dunked his head into a swimming pool until he almost drowned. They pulled out his fingernails and applied electric shock to sensitive private parts of his body. He was lucky to survive. If an Iraqi soldier is found dead in a neighborhood, they burn to the ground all the houses in the general vicinity and would not let firefighters come until only ash and rubble was left. The Iraqis were making fun of President Bush and verbally and physically abusing my family and me on our way out of Kuwait. We only did so because life in Kuwait became unbearable. They have forced us to hide, burn, or destroy everything identifying our country and our government. I want to emphasize that Kuwait is our mother and the Emir our father. We repeated this on the roofs of our houses in Kuwait until the Iraqis began shooting at us. And we shall repeat it again. I am glad I am 15, old enough to remember Kuwait before Saddam Hussein destroyed it, and young enough to rebuild it. Thank you.
Mayor, I thank you. Let me thank all of our witnesses.
I can go further.
We saw this in Ukraine as well when we were told that Vladimir Putin just woke up one day and decided to go bomb a maternity ward. Turns out that was fake. We heard fables about the ghost of Kyiv. That was fake. I mean, they tell you anything that they... Weapons of mass destruction. That wasn't enough, so we're on to killing babies. The ghost of Kyiv wasn't enough, and so now we're on to Vladimir Putin is bombing maternity wards. Well, it turns out that was an empty building.
You can go farther back to the First World War. You remember the Belgian babies who the German soldiers hacked off the hands?
Yes.
So it goes like a red thread through the history of propaganda enabling to start or continue or escalate wars. So you find that almost all over the place. So it's not a Jewish monopoly, but when it comes to the size and the dimension of lies, the Holocaust has probably the, as I say, it's the best documented event of history and the most testified about event of history. Now, to both statements, I agree. Most testified. Second, maybe, or just barely ahead of the medieval witch trials, of which we have, particularly in Germany, there are still old records of tens of thousands of witness statements about how the witches did it, of having sex with the devil and poisoning food and manipulating the weather and that kind of stuff. And it's on a similar level, sometimes it's what we hear about the Holocaust. And it's the best documented event in history, too. But not the way you think, because what we have now created with those 53 volumes of the Holocaust handbooks, that's where we really go into the documents. The Holocaust history, as the mainstream tells us, was written, the Orthodox version was written in the first three decades after the war, when the world did not really have access to the the documents, because most of them were actually in the Eastern Bloc in archives that we had no access to. This access became possible in the when the Soviet Union collapsed. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of documents. And we've gone into the archives. Particularly the Italian historian Carlo Mattogno with his colleagues went into archives all over Eastern Europe and Russia and got tens of thousands of documents and started systematically looking at what really happened, what is documented. And that is one of the main threads that runs through this series of 53 volumes. And there is this complete opposition between the testimonies that we were all fed and what the documents say. The unbridgeable gap of contradictions, and the question is, how did that all come about? And I, in this new book that I've written, actually based on what is, if you go into the encyclopedia, it is what is summarized here in the book is it places also in contained in the encyclopedia, but in separate disconnected entries, so it doesn't really connect the dots. I had to put the dots together and make a proper narrative out of it. When it comes to how the gas chamber story formed, you have to go to the sources. You have to go to the early testimonies that were made right after the war, or still during the war, during the time when the story evolved during wartime propaganda, starting in 42, late 41, 42, into 43, but then really massively right after the war, 45, 46, 47, when the Polish authorities, and we're talking about Poland here, all six so-called extermination camps, Berzek, Chełmno, Auschwitz, Majdanek, Sobibor, and Treblinka, they're all located in what is today Poland. And so the investigations at war's end or after the war were all conducted by Polish authorities. Already during the war, propaganda was spread, created and spread by the Polish underground, by the Polish government in exile that sat in London, who gathered that information or disinformation and spread it with the help of the British government. And you look at the early testimonies that were given by survivors, be it Auschwitz, Berzek, there are very few, but Sobibor and Treblinka, both camps had uprisings. There were a number of several hundred inmates that fled from these camps, and many of them made testimonies, testified after the war. And it is amazing to see what they testified and compare it with the story that we're told today, because again, there is not really a connection between the two. The most startling example is the Sobibor camp, which most people may never have heard of, but it is one of the three so-called pure extermination camps that was Berzek, Treblinka, and Sobibor. Sobibor is the smallest of them, but it is one where we have an uprising and therefore hundreds of survivors who testified right after the war. They all tell kind of the same story, that people were gassed at Sobibor using chlorine, and after the gassing, the gas chamber floors opened downward, like they had big flaps at floors that could open downward hydraulically somehow, and all the dead bodies fell into carts underneath in some basement area where railway with some railway carts was running, and then those carts would ferry them away to mass graves or to pyres. This mechanically very challenging solution of the problem goes with almost all the testimony. I would say, if you look it up, three-quarter or 80% of all witnesses tell that story. And the others who don't tell it, don't tell any particulars about how it has happened. So you have an agreement among those witnesses how exactly it happened. When you look at today's narrative, that was developed in 1947 by a Polish judge having just interrogated those witnesses, he then sat down and wrote, people were gassed with engine exhaust gas in a normal chamber, and then when they were dead, they were just taken out and carried to mass graves. So what the story that he is wrote in 1947 about Sobibor, which we're told to this day, because it's based on this. It has nothing to do with what witnesses told. Nothing. He threw out all witnesses and copied the version he had just created a year before for the Treblinka camp. And then we go to Treblinka, we have a similar situation there. Hundreds of witnesses that survived an uprising. And you look at what they said. And there you have people saying the killings happened with steam, the killing happened with engine exhaust, the killing happened with electricity, that is to say, high voltage shocks, the killing happened with chlorine, the killing happened with some delay action, gas, and many other completely invented ways of how the murder cycle have happened. Completely contradictory. And what the judge, the same judge, did in this case, again, he threw out what didn't fit and agreed, well, the most likely is that engine exhaust gas was used and there's just a normal room and people were killed and then taken away. He copied that over to Soviet war. So you see that basically for all these camps, completely disparate witness accounts that had evidently nothing to do with a possible reality, uncoordinated, chaotic, complete witness anarchy, because those Jewish witnesses, mostly, almost all of them were Jews when we're talking about these camps. Auschwitz was a mixed barrel of Jews and mostly Polish Christians. These witnesses evidently didn't coordinate their stuff well, except for Sobibor. They agreed on those opening floors, but that was invented. But the Polish judge that went in and cleaned house agreed on some kind of solution that seemed credible and threw out everything else. So there was evidently some coordination that came from the Polish judiciary, whether that judge, there are actually three judges and one historian that were in charge of all these six camps making up these stories, with which we are stuck today. How exactly this was done, whether there was orders from the Kremlin, because we're talking Stalinist Poland, or the Stalinist Polish government, cooperating with the remnants of the nationalist government in Polish exile. We don't know. We haven't found anything about that yet. But it is conspicuous that those four Polish individuals, three judges and one historian, basically created that story out of whole cloth from a completely chaotic witness mess. And this is what Western historian ever since, and now every historian in the world, is regurgitating the story that was made up by the Polish judiciary in the early post-war years. Nobody really goes to the sources. You find them in the encyclopedia, under entry Sobibor Treblinka. I give a summary. There's big tables of all the witnesses that testified, and they are in the Nazi gas chamber book too, that have testified right after the war what they have told, and you can see that it is completely disparate. So now, I have not been able to verify that any of those Polish judges who did that streamlining of the story had any Jewish background. It seemed that they did not. It doesn't mean that there weren't any superiors that were Jewish. But for now, what I see from that is that, of course, witnesses for the most part have been Jews because they were the main inmates in those camps. Inevitably, they were the main witnesses. But the coordination does not seem to have been dominated by Jews at the very level where it happened. The Poles have, if you look at the history, the Poles have a similar interest as the Zionists or the Jews to portray themselves as victims and to take advantage of it. So they are kind of, they have a similar interest. If you, for instance, if you were to look at a map of Europe of 1914, just before the First World War broke out, and you overlay it with a map of 1990, just after Germany was reunited, as we know it today, and with Poland, you would see that half of the territory which constitutes Poland today used to be German territory before the First World War. So in two world wars, the Poles grabbed and doubled their territory from Germany. Now, the smaller part was done after the First World War, and that's how the Second World War actually broke out, because of territorial dispute on Danzig and the surrounding area. But that was a smaller part. The bigger part really came after the Second World War, when there was a massive ethnic cleansing of Germans from the eastern, what used to be East Germany. My family, actually my paternal family, was expelled in that process too. So the Poles had an interest to somehow make the Germans never to ask for justice and restitution and reparation and giving back the territories, which
of course, because who would support that? And this is the justification that Israel needs to ethnically cleanse the West Bank and
so you see,
Gaza.
You see parallels there, and the Poles have an interest in inculcating in the Germans a feeling of eternal guilt, and that's what they've done and succeeded with. The Germans, and I'm one of them, and I know because I've grown up in this society, the Germans have accepted the model that we Germans were so bad during the Second World War, in particular with the Holocaust, that we had it coming, we deserved it, and we have to accept what was done to us as justified punishment. So this was basically a policy, a Polish policy of securing their spoils of war, has worked splendidly. And I'm not advocating reversing anything here. I'm against territorial disputes, particularly when they turn into violent actions like we see them in Ukraine and Russia now. It's a disaster for Europe that Europeans are killing each other over land, when the European Union, with all the bureaucratic chaos that's going on, but at least the one thing that is positive about it is Germans now, there is no border between Poland and Germany to speak of. If Germans want to go back to the lands of their fathers and settle there, they can do that, and some actually do that. So there's no reason for bashing our heads in over territory. We should be over that in Europe. I'm just looking at historically to explain what happened, why it happened, which motives were behind that. And I see the motives with the Poles very clearly securing their territorial grab and the ethnic cleansing. And the Jewish push to secure their land in Palestine with Holocaust propaganda has actually started much, much later. That came, I would say, only around the Eichmann trial in 1961. That's when they really ramped up their engine of propaganda. Before that, in 1948, that may have been in the background, but then the State of Israel had different problems. They were, of course, using that to get reparation from Germany, and to allow Germany back into the ranks of civilized nations, so to say. Germany, West Germany in particular, needed the ability to get loans and to get international trade contracts, and the Zionists, the Jews with influence, were putting a stop to this. And the United States twisted some Israeli arms to come to an agreement between Germany and Israel. Israel allows Germany international trade again. Germany accepts responsibility for the Holocaust and accepts the narrative. That's official West Germany, the government. And then Israel got money and infrastructure from Germany to build up Israel. But when it comes to pushing the Holocaust narrative itself, as it was developed by Polish judiciary, Israel started that in the 1960s.
So HolocaustEncyclopedia.com is where you're going to find this book, HolocaustEncyclopedia.com. And as Gerhardt was saying, HolocaustHandbooks.com really goes over a lot of these documents in great detail when you go to HolocaustHandbooks.com. And Germar's new book, you can find it, armreg.us, armreg.us, Nazi Gas Chambers, The Roots of the Story. I only have a couple of minutes left here, but I wanted to ask you, what did you find as far as inconsistencies or consistencies in the way of populations, both before and then in comparison to after the alleged events of the Holocaust?
mainstream narrative is that 6 million are missing, of course. They did a study in 1991. It was published, and they came to the conclusion 6 million are missing. And how they did that is they basically took the last census they had in every country where Jews were counted, and the first one after the end of the war, several years usually afterwards, made a difference, and then tally it up and came to 6 million. What they did not do is consider that in between, and the last census of any country wasn't just before the war broke out, but sometimes several years, in between the last before and the first after the war, there was a massive Jewish immigration. Before the outbreak of the war, mainly to the United States, but also to Palestine, which turned later into Israel. And after the war in particular, it was a massive influx of Jewish survivors from all over Europe going into Israel. So that was completely ignored. And if you deduct that, the 6 million goes down to some 4 million, 4.5 million. And then you go into the details and look at the narrative of various claims. The main countries we're looking at is Hungary, Poland, and the Soviet Union. How many Poles, Jews died in those countries? And then you have to actually look at the events for Hungary. We're looking at the extermination of Hungarian Jews in Auschwitz in the late spring and summer of 1944. And the interesting thing is that the narrative is tens of thousands of people arrived there within a few days, starting in mid-May. And the crematoria there could not cope with all these people. They were allegedly all killed right on the spot, so that massive outdoor pyres were burning and covering the sky in the area with thick smoke. And as I just mentioned, there are plenty of Allied reconnaissance air photos that show that there weren't any pyres burning, that there were no smoke. There was no smoke anywhere in sight, not in May, not in June, not in July. It didn't happen. So this whole story of 400,000 Hungarian Jews killed obviously is wrong. Something else happened, and now we have a study in Politics of Slavery, Labor, I think it's volume 52. There are documents, and they show tens of hundreds of thousands of these Jews were deported to be used as forced laborers to the end of the war in a program, what they call the interceptor program. They wanted to build more interceptor planes to shoot down the carpet bombing Allied bomber fleets. And they were desperate to do that and needed labor for that, workers, and they decided they are trying to use the Hungarian Jews for that. So there's massive documentations of 150,000 at least that we can trace. And many of them we cannot exactly trace when it comes to people that were not employable, children, elderly, and women with mothers with children. They were not sent to forced labor. It's not clear what happened to them. But we know they weren't burned. They didn't end up on smoking pyres, because the documents, air photo documents, clearly say so. So I do not know the answer how many actually died. Because the statistical data is too chaotic. The war at the end was too chaotic to come to conclusions. What we can say, it weren't 6 million. It was probably not 4 million either. It's less than that. But anyhow, that more detail would be a little bit on the speculative side, and I don't want to go in that territory. Could be one, could be two, could be three, I don't know.
Atrocities happened. It was a war. It was a world war. Bad things happened. We're not going to say that they didn't. There's a Chicago Tribune article that a lot of you may find interesting as well. It's titled, Fixing the Numbers at Auschwitz. Gone now are the inscriptions in 16 different languages, in 16 different places. All of these people that were allegedly killed at Auschwitz. The inscriptions are gone because the numbers were fake. And again, I'm not saying that bad things didn't happen at Auschwitz, but my question is, was the overall 6 million number ever adjusted after the Auschwitz revelations? Of course they weren't, because it was 6 million before that, and it remains 6 million now. I've got 2 minutes left, Gerhardt. Final words.
if you add up all the maximum numbers that were claimed after the war, 4 million for Auschwitz, 3 million for Treblinka, 5 million for Belzec, 2 million for Sobibor, and so on and so on, you end up with a number that is around 25 million. So you can see all these numbers were greatly exaggerated. The 6 million numbers had nothing to do with a single exaggerated numbers. Each one of them is exaggerated. They have to be downsized, and we have to really look at it. With Auschwitz, we can trace almost every person by name, 135,500, still a horrible number. The new plaques that they put up after they removed the old ones, just say 1.5 million. They've reduced it again to 1 million now, but it's still not the end. 135,500 are documented. We're talking about documented history. That's what documented. Still a terrible number, but most of them by disease, typhus epidemics.
Gerhard Rudolph, thank you so much for all of your hard work, for the book, for the encyclopedia, for the handbooks, for being here, for informing us. We appreciate your time. God bless you.